Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and we have another two-hour radio broadcast, thanks to BBS Radio and Don and Doug and the crew at BBS. My name's Christopher. I like to go by my full name. My background is as a psychologist. I'm a PhD clinical psychologist, as well as a forensic psychologist, as I worked in the prison system for 12 years. But my long 30-year interest has been in the study and science of human consciousness. And through this program, what I attempt to do is present the issues of consciousness as they are posed and as they arise within modern psychology and science. And then I also explain mystical, spiritual, and esoteric ideas, occult ideas about the origins and nature of human consciousness. So what I'm attempting to do is explain an alternative model of the nature of human existence based on occult teachings, but integrating it with modern physics and science. So through zero-point studies, you get a radically alternative model of the nature of human existence. And it's not something that one can simply grasp with the mind, but it is a deeper teaching that has to be understood over time and through one's own awakening and development of consciousness. Gurdjieff, the mystic philosopher, explained, people don't understand consciousness because they don't have it. They're not properly conscious. Gurdjieff explained that human beings form what he calls a false consciousness system. And this false consciousness system is based on the conditioning by the environment and by external influences, which condition a person into this false consciousness system. Now, in truth, Gurdjieff explains that our true consciousness then passes into the subconscious. So our essential consciousness is lost, and we have this false consciousness system that forms over it. We also explored the idea of zero points, meaning a point so small that it disappears from view. It looks like almost like nothing. So the idea is of there being a point at zero point levels, beyond the level of perception, and that a human being has such a zero-point center within the higher dimensional physics of the human heart, that there's actually a higher dimensional physics to your heart. Your heart's not simply a physical thing, but you also have a psychical heart, you have a spiritual heart, and ultimately a divine source emanation, a spiritual spark within the higher dimensions of the human heart. In Kabbalistic teachings, it's explained that there are four worlds which emanate out of the nothingness at the beginning of time. These are the worlds of emanation, creation, the world of formation, and the world made. So these would correspond to a human being has fourfold nature then. And in the world of emanation, you have a divine source emanation, a divine spark. Okay. Aleister Crowley says the first principle of magic, he says, every man and woman is a star. So you are a star. That is in your higher dimensional nature. You have this little divine source emanation that exists in higher dimensional space. And then the influences of that are stepped down into the world of creation, which is the spiritual world. So you have a self that exists within the spiritual world. You have the spiritual level of the human heart is related to this higher dimensional spiritual world. And then you have the world of formation, and that is the world of the soul or the psyche, that the spirit ensouls the material body. So the world of formation corresponds to your psychical heart and energetic heart. And then you have the world made, and that is your physical heart. So in the teaching I'm trying to explain, the concept is that I, within the human being, like your basic awareness of being existence, your I in you, originates out of the physics of the heart, and the consciousness and vitality within you spreads through your body, through your bloodstream. That the human being is ensouled through the blood flow and the oxygenation of the blood through the breath. And in the Bible we read, God breathes into man a living soul. So your soul life is connected to your breath life, and they're connected to your blood. And this is somehow the house spirit from higher dimensions ensouls the human being and the physical body. So anyway, we range across over a wide range of discussions in these talks, and it certainly takes time to understand the implications and applications of all that I'm saying and where it fits with our usual knowledge. Today, the first part of the show, I have a guest, Mark, from the Ottawa 9/11 Truth Group, and I'm going to have Mark on in a couple minutes, and we'll discuss some of the events that went on in Ottawa over the past week since the last show. And then after that, Jim and I are going to share a discussion of an article, a recent article from the New York Review of Books, an article by physicist Steven Weinberg. So we'll be elaborating some of what I teach and what scientists propose through the second half of today's show. Ideally, if I had my way, the shows would focus primarily or exclusively on explaining these consciousness, the science of consciousness and the heart and the zero-point concepts and things like this. But as one wakes up and one realizes how humankind on our planet has this incredible false consciousness system, which has been intentionally engendered through the media and through your education, and that in a way everything we've been taught and everything we think we know is a lie. It's all based on falsity. And awakening to this is like awakening to the truth of 9/11, and you realize, oh, you've been told this complete lie about 9/11, how these Muslim men hijacked these planes and everything, and the whole thing's a complete lie. It has about as much truth as the story of Santa Claus. Okay, Osama bin Laden and his reindeers didn't bring down the towers. Instead, something completely different happened, and the masses of humankind have been completely deceived about it and have no understanding of it. And people are so caught up with everything in their life, people don't realize the broader scene of what's happening on our planet at this time in human history. We live in a time of epic dimensions. It's like a grand Lord of the Rings. We're in a great Lord of the Rings tale. And book two of the Lord of the Rings is The Two Towers, which kind of represent the two towers in New York City and the kind of destruction of the two towers. And there's a worldwide battle on between the forces of light and darkness, that there are spiritually oriented people in life, but then there are satanically oriented individuals and groups in life. Truly, truly evil, evil men and women who propagate this have intentionally deceived the human race and carry on plans for eugenics and poisoning people and terrible things around the world. So what people think is the reality of Canadian life and American life, in a way, the whole thing is based on lies. The democracy is a lie. The free media is a lie. Being told the truth is a lie. There's so many lies. Everything we think we know, the medicines that we take, so many lies. Everything is built on lies that one thought one knew, and one can wake up and then begin to realize all these lies. And the false consciousness system, which has been created in the sheep people, the people who go along and just watch their TV for 3 to 4 hours a night and have their opinions about everything, but are completely asleep to the deviousness of our own governments and what's really happening in the world situation. The media keeps people completely dumbed down, so they don't know essential things happening within the world situation. So we have a pretty colossal epic tale of humankind occurring at this time. And book 3 of Lord of the Rings is Return of the King. And I think of that would be the return of righteousness in the world, the return of truth, the return of justice. That would be the return of the king. And we as humankind, maybe there'll be a return of the king, or else we're going to be in an Orwellian fascist state fashioned for us by the satanic elite. And this is the true story of what's happening on planet Earth. But most people just stay home like hobbits. They don't face the enemy. But around the world, there are forces of light, people gathering and waking up to the horrors of what is being done within our own societies and within the world situation. So around the world, there are forces massing to try to rein in the insanity of these groups. Anyway, First, I'd like to switch over then and introduce my co-host, James Moffat from Toronto. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Good. How are you, Chris? Can you hear me all right on this phone?
Yes, I can. I can hear you well. Am I a bit soft to you? Or?
No, it's just I'm on my cordless, and I was sitting outside because it's such a beautiful day, and I was wondering if you could hear me okay. I was having a bit of problems, but I think it was my other phone, so I switched phones. So.
It's fine. Have a look in your sky. Can you see any chemtrails?
No, I can't see anything. It's pretty clear for Toronto. I mean, we can't see anything because of the pollution normally, so.
Yeah, wow. Here in Ottawa, we go through periods. Like, we had 2 heavy days back on 9/11, but then we went almost a week with no chemtrails.
Yeah.
But then the last 2 days, it's about the heaviest chemtrail spraying I've ever seen here.
Wow.
There's like, I can see, by going out in the sky, I can see at least 20 or 30 big chemtrails, and they come down, they form kind of elongated clouds and such. Our whole sky is filled with chemtrails. I don't think I've ever seen it so massively. Had you noticed that, Mark?
No, actually I haven't. It was raining a few days there after 9/11.
Yeah.
So I wasn't looking up. I was avoiding the rain.
Well, today and yesterday we've had massive chemtrail spraying in the Ottawa region. I know it because I watch. I've taken some photos and videos of them. It's amazing, and it was funny being out today and going to a mall and trying to tell people, look up, look, look. Look at the clouds. Look at the clouds. Wake up. You're being poisoned. And it's good to do that when they're actually there in the sky, so a person can actually look up and see them and actually maybe think for a moment about it before they fall back asleep. Mark, you're there. Welcome, Mark. Maybe you might like to tell us a little bit about the 9/11 truth events in Ottawa.
Sure. Thank you very much, Christopher, for having me on your show again. The last Thursday, September 11th, was an absolutely huge success. If people have been listening to your show in the past, they would have heard me referring to the March on Ottawa, which was a Canada-wide convergence on Parliament Hill on Thursday, September 11th. It was also the culmination of a 4-day march from Montreal to Ottawa on foot for several people. There were, I think, 30 people that marched over those 4 days. We had a gathering of well over 100 people on the hill representing 15 plus cities in Canada. I wanted to list them, but I don't want to forget anybody. So it's posted on the website. So if you go to Ottawa911truth.com and you click on our report, you will get to see a whole pile of pictures. You get to see a whole pile of videos. And you'll also get to see, I've listed as many cities as I overheard, as I saw in communication with. It was a huge success. We had no injuries. We had no accidents. We had no arguments. We were allowed to bullhorn all day. The police were excellent. They never once even harassed, like nothing. They didn't bother us at all. We were surveilled by two helicopters. We did have Gordon MacDonald of the Privy Council's office come out and film the protesters, so there was some stuff going on. But for
who
the
was
most
it
part,
who came out and was filming the protesters?
It's already up on YouTube. Somebody from the Privy Council office came out and was actually filming the protesters at noon, at the beginning of the march.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he got surrounded. There were seven cameras on him at one point. And through people hammering him with questions, he spilled his name and his blog. And so, boom, he's up on the Internet, you know.
Yeah, good.
Yeah. So, but I mean, and that, there was another police officer who commented, and that's on YouTube as well, that he had never seen so many cameras ever at a protest. Like, many protests, but he couldn't believe how many cameras there were here. And it's a reflection of a couple of things. One, it's the convergence of 10 cities, so a lot of people brought their own cameras to get their own footage. Like, I'm saying 10 because the 10 major truth groups, there were more cities than that. There are actually four more truth groups which have spawned as a result of this. Quebec City, Saskatoon, Sherbrooke, and Kitchener. So
wow,
we have
excellent.
Four new truth groups just started up. Now, some may have started a few months earlier, I'm not sure, but I only became aware of them after this march. So so it's spreading. We had a guy from splittingthesky.net. He came down from, that was the Fraser Valley Group and the Calgary Group that got him together.
He spoke so wonderfully on Parliament Hill.
And
what a shocking talk, eh?
Yeah.
I saw some of the video of that.
Yeah, it's excellent. There's if you go to Ottawa911truth.com, you can see the tribute video. It's the first tribute video that's come out, which tries to capture the whole day.
Yeah.
There's going to be more. There's if you click on see our videos, we've got probably about 40, 50 videos posted already, and those are just the ones I've found.
Wow.
So they're still coming out. Last time I was on, you were calling from the CAP convention, the Canadian Action Party convention.
Mm-hmm.
I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Andrew Moulton at that, at the march on September 11th.
Yeah.
And, he's quite impressive. When he started getting into the talks about vaccines, it was shocking, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so that must have been the thing you saw at the CAP convention, correct?
Yeah.
So he had, he was very convincing, very nice guy. We had a lot of people come out from different areas, and it was beautiful. And the thing I'd like to also point out is it was not orchestrated by the Ottawa 9/11 Truth Group. We didn't post a sign saying, or a thing on the web saying, please come to Ottawa September 11th. It was the Vancouver 9/11 Truth Society and the Montreal 9/11 Truth Society, which got together and converged, and then they expanded it to include many other cities in Canada. And then when we all converged, it was beautiful. It was rallying, like a meeting of generals. It was phenomenal. And now they're going back. It's my hope that next year, on September 11th, 2009, that they will take it to their own cities and, take what they learned here and bring it back to their cities for next year. So I don't know. It was phenomenal. You were there. It was.
Well, at points, like, feeling, like, empowered so much, eh? It's so nice being in company of people who kind of know the truth and want justice and are outraged by what's being done and, you know, people knowledgeable about what's happening. I see the people out there, like, they're brave in a way because we're up against such deviousness and such horrible things in our country, you know? And those people are brave to go out and kind of wanting truth, you know.
Well, Canada got pretty far because Canada actually got a petition into our parliament, which was read by Libby Davies from the NDP. She actually read it into parliament, and it was supposed to be chaired on September 15th when parliament resumed. Instead, we had an election call, and now we don't know what's happened to it. Now, on September 11th, I tried to go and talk to Paul Dewar, my MP, in Ottawa Center, and he literally turned and ran and into his back office. And then his, of course, his campaign advisor stopped me at the door and said, "Oh, no, you know, you can't talk to him right now," even though we had just seen him right in the window look at us and then bolt into the back. So it was kind of ridiculous, because I don't care what the issue is, you know, it's an election cycle. You shouldn't be running and hiding from constituents, you know?
Well, he knows he can't speak the truth. He can't.
But
I mean, he could, but he won't.
He ran like a vampire seeing a cross. It was terrible. And
and
I have never spoken to Paul Dewar before in my life, so it's not like I have a past history with him, and he knew who I was. He saw my T-shirt, and that was it. He was gone. So,
yeah.
But we got it on film. I don't know what we're going to do with it, but, I mean, it just goes to show that, you know, we got a petition into our parliament. It was about to be read. But then if I wanted to say take that petition back up and get my MP to read it in, my MP won't even speak to me about it, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, see, the way I see it, the government can't speak about it because the same people who did 9/11 own your government. So your government can't tell you the truth because it would implicate themselves in all these crimes. So they, by hook or by crook, it won't be done. You know, maybe they'll come out and have some other lies, you know, and that's all that will be done. Otherwise, they hide from people.
It's pretty ridiculous anyways, but there are so many people to thank for the event, how it went. I know you've had Matthew on in the past. Matthew was one of the driving forces in Ottawa for coordinating things with the police, things with the parade route, phone calls with the bus that was coming from Vancouver. There was a lot of work behind the scenes to pull the day off, but the day off went off without a hitch. And the one thing I would like to mention is that last year, in 2007, CBC Radio and CTV's A Channel did not have hundreds of people outside yelling at them in 2007 or 6 or 5 or 4, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They did this year, and it was beautiful. The video for that hasn't even come out yet.
Oh yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, we were calling them liars and the crowd, and yeah, I read out to them or reminded them of their Nuremberg
decision. That was at CBC. I saw that video. I know at A Channel before I got there, the weather guy had been setting up, and then they ran back inside the building and locked up. So
yeah,
it'll be interesting to see that footage. So they did scurry. It is interesting. You say it's not a real issue. Nobody cares. What's the big deal? Well, try to talk to your media about it or your MPs and watch them run. It's ridiculous. They know, you know.
But they all do know. That's the problem, eh? They all know. They all know the truth.
I really disagree with that. I don't think that's the case at all. I really, really strongly disagree with that. I'm sorry. I don't think they know. I mean, yeah, some of them know, but I don't think they all do know. I really don't. I just don't see that. I don't think it's... I think there are a lot of people that just... They don't want to know. I think that's the
that's one. More likely, because we handed Paul Dewar 6 documentaries on the Monday, September 8th or whatever. He also received the documentary Zero on September 11th from Tyrone Drummond, another truther in Ottawa. So physical, you know, or video evidence anyways of what we're talking about has been delivered to him. But the thing is, if he doesn't pop it into the DVD player and watch it, then he doesn't want to know, or he won't, you know, he refuses to know, however you want to word it.
I think that's quite different from saying that they do know, and Chris is saying they know. Well, I don't think they do know, a lot of them. I asked my MP, came to the door today campaigning. She's an NDP member, Peggy Nash, and I asked her about it. And I said, you know, what do you know about that? And her answer was really interesting. She said, well, there are enough real conspiracies to be concerned about without this. And I said, well, with all due respect, I think I urged her to go to www.patriotsfortruth.org and look at that. And I said, look at the people that are on there. And I said, start looking at that. And then we started talking, and I said, you know, one of the compelling reasons to believe the conspiracy is that in the Project for the New American Century, they told you they were going to do it. And she acknowledged that she was aware of that. And I said, so it's not so far-fetched they basically tell you this is what we need. And yeah. She said, well, it certainly set in motion everything that they wanted to happen. She actually admitted
right.
that. So that was a step up from an outright. I mean, she didn't run away. I'll give her that. And she didn't. But I thought her that comment about real conspiracies, you know, is completely ridiculous. But
yeah, it is.
Yeah, but
I mean, this is the smoking
conspiracy.
Gun of the whole thing.
Everything else. I mean, everything that's happened in the last 7 years all derives from this event and the interpretation of what happened. I mean, it's completely ridiculous to not look at.
Why we're in Afghanistan? And if you ask the average person why are we in Afghanistan, they won't know first off, and then but they will say, well, it's because of 9/11. You know, they don't know the details, but they know it stems from 9/11. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know what I was told over during September 13th when I was out at the table on the market with the 9/11 group. Lady there told me that Harper has shares in Unico Oil.
That's
isn't that interesting, eh?
Even the people that are building the pipeline to Central Asia?
Well, what happened in Afghanistan was that the United States government paid the Taliban salaries and supported them as a government for the 2 years before the invasion.
Right.
But at one point, the Taliban didn't agree to Unico Oil's terms for the use of the pipeline. So
actually, it's Unical. Yeah, and there's a rival pipeline from Argentina or Brazil, I believe, which is when they started to waffle on support for Unical. That's when they became the enemies.
Well, it was that, and it was also their destruction of the opium fields, and also they were talking about turning to the euro and for oil money. So different aspects to it. So, but I mean, it was a war based on lies, and the government knows it, and they've completely allowed the Canadian population to be deceived about it. So we have a pretty serious situation.
If you go to the March on Ottawa website, he has a good quote. Next time someone shows up at your door and wants to ask if you're voting, the question that you ask them is, do you support our demand for an investigation into the 24 deaths that happened on September 11th? I thought that was a very powerful question. You can also submit your questions to the leaders' debate, too. I forgot to mention that. The website for that is question@electionsdebate.ca, although electiondebate08.ca, but my opinion is they will just screen it out and won't read it.
Yeah, they'll just screen it out. Yeah, they have to. They can't face these people publicly with it because
no,
it would...
No, but if you hammer them with enough messages that you want that, maybe, you know... You show them that they're wide open and exposed. It's not much, but it's something.
did the CBC or the CTV or Global cover the march on Parliament Hill?
They brought out cameras in the morning. I will give them credit for that. Both CBC and A Channel brought out cameras at noon, September 11th. The thing is, they did not bring reporters. They did what they always do at protests. They don't bring reporters. They just bring the camera, and they wander around basically surveilling people, making them feel uncomfortable, and then they go back with that footage and add whatever words they want.
I thought I saw
on the footage, I have a friend who's a cameraman for CBC National News, and I thought I saw him walk by in one of the shots, and I thought, well, it looks like CBC's there, and I thought I recognized somebody else who I know who's a camera person, so I wondered if, but I never actually saw any real coverage of the...
And, well, the thing is, we were on the Hill, so if they did cover it on the news that day, I have not seen the footage.
Yeah, did you see anything, Chris? Was there
no, any... I didn't.
No, I was watching, and I just didn't see anything, but I also didn't see every newscast, so I'm not
right.
really sure.
Yeah, so I'm hoping they covered it. I don't know if they did, and I don't know what they've covered, so I don't really want to base an opinion of it, but if they would have brought a reporter out, you know, with the cameraman,
yeah,
I think it would have been so much more effective, you know?
Well, we took it to them at one point when the whole group marched down on Spark Street, and we went along to the CBC building, and we were all outside and kind of...
They were holding signs, pressing them up against the window while the guy was trying to do a live broadcast.
Yeah, and all the reporters hiding from the news.
There are bullhorns echoing off the building, off the walls. I mean, they never had that happen last year or the year before. Now they're having it happen. Now the people are waking up. There's there's a big awakening happening right now. Like with, if you go to splittingthesky.net, he's got a 2-hour presentation, and it shows actually when we were doing that group photo setting up for that, it shows it in sped up, you know, real time, or, but you know what I mean, where they speed it up. But he actually goes in, and then he starts naming names. He starts saying, it's this person, it's that person. These are the people who are behind 9/11 because he followed the money. And I've never heard anybody actually do that before, so I recommend everybody go and check out that presentation because his stuff is sourced, you know. And
yeah, it's like that new movie, 9/11 Missing Links.
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, well, it's also identifying the people, too. Like,
okay, great.
That's how what I see's happened in the 7 years since 9/11 happened. Like, at that time, people have always just demanded to want an investigation, but now it's like people have put it together, and it's evident who these people are. And,
well, people have spent the last 7 years verifying their sources before they come out and blame people.
Yeah, I mean, it was very complicated to put together. I mean, you see why there have been hundreds of scientists have worked at it, you know, all different aspects, like the, you know, why you have the Architects for Truth and the Pilots for Truth and all these different groups who take apart different aspects of the whole event.
Yeah, and it's all coming together. And if you watch the footage that came out, the two groups that I wasn't aware of is the Mohawk Nation is now aware. And the other one was some bikers in between Winnipeg and Sault Ste. Marie.
Yeah.
They fixed the Truth Bus up. They got it going, and they bought a bunch of T-shirts, 9/11 Truth T-shirts.
That's really cool.
It just shows that everybody knows, you know.
Yeah.
And, if there's anything that's going to bring the country together, it's something like that. So.
Well, I mean, I think in a way there needs to be a turning around among our politicians and in the intelligence community and in the police community. Like, we need our public people to kind of, you know, actually, we need the police to actually capture a criminal, you know, like to go and arrest people, you know, for crimes, these crimes.
Don't hold your breath. I told that Bea today that we put the wrong people in prison, and she laughed.
You said that to the MP?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I said, we don't put these corporate criminals in prison. We put people who have drug problems in prison. We not only don't put corporate criminals in prison, we give them $8 million bonuses when they screw things up, you know.
Yeah.
And she laughed, you know, and she said, well, exactly, you know. So, yeah, there's some hope, I suppose, among some people that, it's so far, though, from where we are. I mean, it's like, you know, you can't even get people to talk about it. So it's like you realize what a incredible struggle it is to get this even into the, you know, into the public consciousness. And I mean, that's where the internet is such a valuable tool to, in terms of organizing and communicating and you know, building some sense of community. But it's very difficult. It's, you know, it's,
well,
I don't know.
So many people are complicit. That's kind of what's happened, and everybody on their side's kind of intimidated into silence.
Well,
in different means, you know. I mean, I'm sorry for them too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very big, important point. I think there's complicity, but I think there's also a lot of pressure on a lot of different people. Like we talked about this before about firefighters and police officers in New York who know that there were explosions in the towers and who, you know, have said privately that they witnessed this, and yet, you know, they can lose their jobs, they lose their livelihood, you know, they can't take care of their families, so they don't say anything publicly, you know, or they're gagged. I mean, that's why you have whistleblower legislation, is because this always happens when people want to speak the truth about something.
Yeah. Yeah, and there have been series of deaths of different people, like they had a major witness die this week who reported bombs going off in Building 7 even before the first airplanes hit the tower.
Really? Well,
in the morning.
Barry Jennings, but they haven't released how he died. It is suspicious that he died 2 or 3 days before the NIST report came out talking about Building 7.
Right.
I've been following that story a little bit. I haven't found out details. Personally, I'm going to wait to say anything until I know how he died. If he died,
well, he was supposed to have been of a heart attack.
Heart attack?
Yeah.
Okay, I haven't heard that.
That's what I'd heard.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you don't know now because they also have their electromagnetic weapons, and I believe they can induce heart attacks in people through their some of their weaponry that they have now.
But taser can do that.
You know, different ways of inducing heart attacks and such. So,
let's say you can drug somebody and induce a heart attack.
Yes.
You don't need to use, like, magnetic weapons. And it's pretty easy to fake a toxicology report, too, or an autopsy.
Exactly.
I just wanted to mention one thing. I don't know. Mark, have you read the book 9/11 and American Empires, Intellectuals Speak Out, that David Ray Griffin and Peter Dale Scott edited? Which I bought it when Dr. Griffin was speaking in Ottawa. Have you read it?
I have not read it, no.
There's a great article. You haven't read it, Chris?
No.
There's a great article just addressing this whole question about conspiracies and, you know, black ops and what governments do. A very important article called The, quote, Strategy of Tension, unquote, in the Cold War Period by Daniel Ganser, who's a Swiss historian, and talks about the armies left behind, the secret armies left behind after the Second World War under NATO's control, which were to fight communist and left-wing influences throughout Europe were supposedly to prepare in case there was a Soviet invasion of these countries, but engaged in all sorts of dirty political tricks and subverted the political process and carried out terrorist operations in Italy. And specifically, this article is mainly about what happened in Italy. Apparently, Ganser has written an entire book about this, but this particular article focuses on what happened in Italy and how bombings and murders were carried out by these right-wing organizations which were sponsored and financed by the CIA and NATO, and the blame was put on the Red Brigades and these left-wing organizations that discredit the communists and left-wings, the socialist movement in Italy. It's a really incredible article. Like, it's really amazing.
It's just so typical. Like, now it's kind of come out so much. The CIA's been doing that around the world for decades, and doing all these devious things and blaming it on people and taking down elected governments and terrible things.
Yeah,
assassinations. And
that means that false flag terrorism has been completely exposed. And with the internet now, they do something, it's only a matter of weeks before it falls apart and it's exposed. So it's the hope that by keeping exposing this stuff, they won't do it again, or they can't do it again.
Yeah.
I know that amongst the Canadian Indian community that there's widespread disbelief in what actually happened in the Air India bombing that this was some sort of a black op, you know, carried out by the Indian government, you know, but that's another whole.
Yeah, I know very little of that. Yeah.
I don't really know that much about it except that the incompetence of the Canadian Security Intelligence Service in that was staggering, and the RCMP is it's an amazing story, it's an amazing tragedy, and yet, you know, 20 years after the fact, that there's never been any real accounting for this or bringing to justice the people that were, you know, that were responsible for it. It's a really a sordid tale, and it just kind of gives you a window into, you know, just the skullduggery that goes on routinely amongst these people. That's just incredible, you know.
Yeah, it's very sad. It's very sad.
Well, there is hope. We are keeping. We're going to keep talking about it. On the Ottawa area, we're going to be out in October 11th at 2 p.m. down in the Byward Market. We're going to continue our 11th of every month campaign. We'll be giving out on September 11th. We gave out over 700 discs. Normally, we give out 300. So we're going to be giving 300 movies away down in the market, October 11th, 2 o'clock.
Wow, excellent. And are you guys, is it possible for you to get out to any, we have an election coming up. I wonder if any people from your group are getting out and trying to videotape confrontations with candidates or anything along that line.
That would be the We Are Change Ottawa group. And they have a website, wearechangeottawa.org.
Uh-huh.
I am not aware personally, but I mean, it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
So yes, it is an election, and it is an important issue. The reason why we're at war, why we got people in Afghanistan,
yeah.
And where is that white paper that Colin Powell was supposed to give us justifying why we're in Afghanistan? it still hasn't shown up. So that was what the petition was about that was entered into Parliament.
Yeah.
So
it's like the truth of the affair is like so obvious now, you know. It's astonishing.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope
really.
People are paying attention. Because if they get carte blanche for another year, then, and also this election, it has me worried because they're timing it with the American election, and I always get the feeling when they call an election when they're not sure of their popularity, mm-hmm. it means they got something planned that people aren't going to like, and so they want to get the election out of the way.
Yeah.
So that's my thoughts. So.
Yeah.
And I know when the Patriot Act was enabled in the U.S., we adopted that within a week. We had our own Patriot Act. I can't remember the name of the bill.
Yeah.
But I know there is a draft bill in the U.S. that just needs to be picked up and voted on. And if they adopted the Patriot Act right away, you know, I'm not saying they're going to, but their track record doesn't look good, so.
Yeah, I mean, we're especially in a dangerous situation now because of the SPP, which allows American, in any emergency situation, the North American can come under the control of the Washington District of Criminals and American forces brought into Canada and
that's
Canadian.
Already allowed.
Sorry?
They've already, in February 14th, a bill was passed, signed by Harper, that allowed U.S. troops to come into Canadian soil anytime they want.
Yeah, really?
They can set up checkpoints on Highway 17, search your vehicles, and if you resist them, if you argue, you already know that they torture their prisoners. So, it's up
yeah.
to you.
Yeah, boy, we have a lot of security and prosperity, eh? Join in with the United States of America for security and prosperity. The security, yeah. Boy.
Not for us.
And prosperity. I mean, the American economy is absolutely collapsing because the elites want to take the money out of everybody's pension plans and impoverish people. Put
well,
so
when
many
I see
taxes
that, I always it. Think, you didn't really think they were going to let all the baby boomers have their pensions, did you?
Well, I mean, I was asleep for so long to everything. It's only within the last 2 years, you know. I had a false consciousness system. I kind of trusted the government, basically, and I trusted the police, basically, and, you know, knew there was corruption in these things, but not such systemic corruption as is there, you know. I had no idea it's so terrible and devious, you know. So for me, it was still a shock. I'm still recovering. I used to believe in justice and protecting the environment, protecting people, and not murdering people for oil and stuff like that. You know, I'm old-fashioned, I guess.
Well, those are all good beliefs. So. But yes, I hope things brighten up. I hope the awareness level is going up on all fronts. On the SPP, on the, you know, secret government, on 9/11, on all of it. I hope that people keep waking up, keep seeing it. And now we've got the architects and engineers on our side. We have a petition that was read into Parliament. We have a lot more than we had 2 years ago. So I'm hoping that this is the year that it happens, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully it's a growing movement and at some point.
Mm-hmm.
We need help from people who are able to kind of turn around, and the whole system has become so deviant. It's really very sad. And my talk, I got to address. Did you hear my address in front of the House of Parliament, Mark?
I did. Yeah, I was standing right there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you were on the mic.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
I called it the House of Criminals. Here I am in front of the Canadian House of Criminals. You know, it used to be the House of Parliament, now it's the House of Criminals. And that's how we're lucky, because in the U.S., you got Washington, D.C., a whole district of criminals.
Yeah.
You know, at least we only have a House of Criminals.
No, it was a great talk. The whole day was great.
It was a good talk, and yeah.
And meeting with like-minded individuals was fantastic, and now we've taken that feeling across Canada. And that's just Canada. They're doing it in the States, too. They had a big gathering in New York. Luke Radowski put that together.
Yeah.
And they had thousands of people in the streets. It was huge. They even got covered by some local media.
Yeah, did they?
Yep, they came out and it was so big. They had
yeah.
to. So.
Yeah, it's like the ante keeps getting upped and upped. I see it. Like, we have the advancement of the New World Order, and at the same time, they're more and more at risk of being exposed and seeking, like, opposition is mounting towards them. Like, they've been revealed too much.
Well, that's
you know, so people are realizing, wow, like, all these devious things are being done, you know.
And have been done. Their past speaks for itself.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm just hoping that things look up for the next few months. We're going to do the winter again like we did last year. We've been doing this since April of 2007, the 11th of every month, and we're going to do it again this winter. Last winter was when our numbers swelled, so after this March, I know on the local level, we have at least 8 more people coming out in October.
Oh, yeah, good.
Yep. They didn't even know we had a movement in Ottawa, and we've done 17 months worth of truth actions. So.
Wow.
So it
was so neat when the whole group, and there must have been like 150 or something, moved from Parliament Hill down Rideau Street all around the market to A Channel, and it was like there were like thousands of people around. You couldn't not hear us and the commotion
and
going through the streets and like telling people all out in cafes and the stores and everywhere, like the whole, all downtown in the heart of Ottawa. Like you couldn't not be shocked a little bit, taken back a bit, the force and energy of that.
It was quite impressive. I can't wait to see the video footage.
Yeah. Yeah, some excellent videos. I just saw one that Tyrone put together, and it was absolutely beautifully done.
That's the compilation one on our website.
It is so good, and it's moving, like the music he has to it. And it's like, wow, I don't know. It's a very moving video. So give the website again at www.ottawa911truth.com. Yeah.
Website. And then the international website, if you're not in Ottawa, is truthaction.org. You can go there and you can find your local group. They're all listed.
Great. And so, all people out there listening, you know, support your local 9/11 groups. You know, it's funny how some people think, oh, that's only in the States for us, and how could it implicate us? They don't realize the whole pattern of deviousness underlying it within both countries. That's the problem. And in a way, you know, it's a symptom of how sick our society has actually become. You know, it really is. It just shows the moral deep.
It's never been seen before, I don't think.
Say again, Mark?
It's a certain level of selfishness that has never been seen before. People are pretty much, now that you've given them handheld televisions, they're pretty much gone, you know? So it's not like it's an oversimplification, but I mean, everybody's lost in their own little world. They're not paying attention to the bigger picture or how other people are manipulating them without them knowing.
No, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I see that when I look at the newspapers. Like, I look at the Ottawa Citizen, which really is trash, really, in terms of informing anyone of what's really going on. You know, they'll have some kind of news item that they'll spin in a certain way, but it's fraudulent as a true media source. And
but
the TV's the same.
Are dropping.
Say?
Their subscription rates are dropping. Their audience is getting older. The younger audience is not picking up the newspapers because they know there's nothing in it. So.
Yeah.
So all of that's good for us, you know, the alternative media.
Yeah.
And so, and it's shows like yours that are going to make the difference because you're not talking about Britney Spears. You're not wasting people's time talking about JonBenet Ramsey still, you know?
Yeah.
So, at least, we're still talking about 9/11, but there are still firefighters who are still dying from it. You know, it's current. There's still people fighting in a war because of it. It's current.
And we're on the verge of having another major, even a third world war, nuclear war, if
Russia.
We don't rein in these elements in our society. I mean, some people are convinced that is on their agenda. They want to have a major nuclear exchange, and that's how they'll...
What I've heard, just reading stuff on the blogs, was that they weren't getting anywhere with the war on terror, so let's stir things back up with Russia.
Oh, yeah.
That's you know, we need some kind of a war before an election, or we're not going to get any votes. So that would be the Republican spin, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't
know. I think McCain has been chosen to be the president. Do you have any feeling about that?
You mean chosen by the elite?
Yeah, I think they've made the choice before the whole thing happens, and then they spin the thing, and then they, you know, they play it out, kind
yeah.
of. It's like a soap opera,
wrestling.
You know?
Yeah, like wrestling match, yeah. I don't know. I think the popular vote is so strong with Obama, although Obama's wife is counsel on foreign relations. He's no solution. His advisor is Zbigniew Brzezinski, so he's no solution. He's in with the same people. I think they're just going to let him have it.
Yeah. Let Obama have it?
Yeah, that's my thought, you know.
Yeah.
That way, because if they try the other way, they're just going to upset so many people, and they already know that. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I mean, they
goes,
do. It is an interesting soap opera. I mean, there are twists and turns to it at different
yeah.
points. It's so funny watching the news sometimes because it's so phony, eh?
Yeah.
In a way, it's so phony.
And all
if
of this
you see
depends
it,
on if Bush will let go of the presidency. Remember, he's made jokes that he wasn't going to step down.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah, we still don't know what could happen. I mean, I think there is a kind of ongoing threat of, you know, international warfare or another state-sponsored terrorist act, you know, of them spreading a disease or something like that, you know. You got, what, 500,000 coffins in Atlanta waiting for something?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
400,000, I think the number was.
Are they
yeah.
the Tupperware? The Tupperware coffins?
Well, they're the liners, apparently, and you can fit three bodies in one, you know.
Oh.
I mean, it's like these people are putting everything in place to kind of carry out genocide against the people, and everybody just ho-hum, ho-hum, you know.
Oh. Well, Canadian
Idol,
you know.
You know, it's all coming down around everybody, and like, people have become so impotent, it's like, I mean, it is overwhelming to kind of face the monstrosity of the whole thing.
Well, I have faith. I have faith that enough people are waking up. Enough times the politicians go out in the public and somebody out of the blue just starts asking about these questions.
Yeah.
It's happening more and more frequently. And
yeah.
They can only dodge so much before it's very obvious that they're dodging. So, and then it reflects on everything else. Like, if you're not going to talk about this issue, what about my other issues that I feel are important, you know?
Yeah.
So here's the whole
thing. Yeah, it was a shame that the Canadian Action Party wasn't in good shape at the time going into the election, and then it came up so quickly. So they only have a small slate of candidates, I think about 40 across the country, which is a real shame, because it's the only party, I would say, which is not a New World Order party. All the other four parties hide the truth of 9/11. And serve the corporate agenda. You see it even in how the NDP don't go around raising the issue of the SPP with people. The NDP doesn't do that. You know, they cover it up. They don't want people to know. If people really understood it, they'd be, you know, they'd realize these guys are scoundrels. You know, ask a politician about why are you allowing them to chemtrail spray us? You know, and then they'll deny it, and then they'll say you need your tinfoil hat and you must believe in UFOs and be anti-Semitic. And once they've tried those ploys, then just say, "Ah, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist."
Yeah, it's sad. Well, we'll see how this election goes. I think we got a good opportunity here to turn things around and let a lot of people know about a lot of different issues that they weren't aware of.
Yeah.
And the only way to see what happens is to do it. So here's
yeah.
hoping everybody confronts a politician about 9/11 tomorrow. When they knock on your door, ask them if they support global deep integration, and ask them if they support a new investigation into the 24 deaths on September 11th.
Tough Canadian.
Yeah, it was funny. I got a call from someone from the Conservative Party. If I was going to vote for this Pierre fellow in my district, who's a current MP, and I told her that you know, the Conservatives were hiding from the Canadian public the truth about 9/11, and so they were complicit in supporting this terrorism, and that really a contribution to the Conservative Party, I considered a contribution to a terrorist organization, and that she was working for a terrorist organization, and that she needed to consider seriously what she was doing, knowing that they're a terrorist organization. She left quite scared. But then she just marks my phone, and then I get, you know, my rating is I'm a red now. I'm color-coded, yeah.
That's less calls, though.
Sorry?
Less calls for you.
But, so okay. Anyway, pretty sad situation. Seems hopeless at times, but it is empowering, and it's funny how so much it does come to waking people up, that's the kind of essential element, is waking people up to realizing this is happening now in our society. You know, this is important. Like, you know, people need to, do you care for your country? You know, do you care for your environment? You know, people are so dummied down. They have no idea how urgent it is to wake up and be aware of what's happening in the world situation.
Well, I think the truth movement's become the new peace movement, and I say that because we're effective where the traditional peace movement isn't. The traditional peace movement used to rely on the media to cover them. The media no longer covers the protests, so they've lost their effectiveness. So our protest on Thursday was unlike any other protest I've ever seen, in that if you walked up to any one of us, we weren't just people waving a flag and yelling stuff. If you walked up to any one of us, and started and asked us a legitimate question about what we're talking about, we all had the answers. We were walking encyclopedias. And they're not prepared for that. You know, the people, we didn't get anybody yelling at us. People, if they asked questions, they usually got a free movie, and they had, a conversation. It was very civil. So that's unlike, like we were the most peaceful protest, and at the same time, we were the loudest when we had to be, and that was reflected in front of A-Channel and CBC.
Yeah, we were quite boisterous going through the streets, and I would like to agree with what you were saying, Mark. I thought the police were excellent. You know, they didn't have a big presence. They handled it. I mean, we're not a violent group. That's not what anyone is advocating. And the police, they were really good, you know.
Yeah.
I'm sure they monitored it a lot, like, secretly that we didn't see, but that's good, you know. They didn't like when we had the Montebello thing where they had hundreds and then thousands of people out in all
snipers,
these unmarked suits
that.
And all geared up pretending they're Darth Vader, you know.
Yeah, no, it was very peaceful. It was great, and I commend everybody that came out for it.
Yeah.
There were so many different truth groups from across Canada that were there represented, even so far as, like, people gathering up signatures in other cities and making sure they got to that bus to get to Ottawa. You know, we had, I think they said over 4,000 signatures on that petition.
Yeah.
And there were only 500 signatures when it was read into Parliament by Libby Davies.
Oh, yeah, really?
So, yeah.
So now 4,000 signatures.
Over 4,000.
Yeah.
So that was a big push, you know. And the more signatures that are on there, the better, because we need them. So.
Yeah, you know, also that some people are trying to arrange Guy Fawkes Day now, eh?
November, yeah.
Yeah, November 5th. Yeah, that they're going to start kind of, you know, for those to be held around the country in front of government offices and things like that, or built, you know, I guess in Ottawa, probably be on Parliament Hill, you know.
Yeah.
The peaceful ones, like they want peaceful ones, but just people to get out and kind of protest the criminality of the government, you know.
Yeah, like the
good.
V for Vendetta ending.
Say again?
The ending for V for Vendetta when all the people marched out.
Yeah. Yeah. So symbolically, it's interesting, you know. It's like wanting, can't people have any justice in our society? You know, it just astonishes me that we got all these police and intelligence services and no one within them does anything. Like, the police aren't police anymore. You know, they carry on this big thing fighting terrorism and everything, and then the known terrorists are just allowed to walk free and are protected. You know, the police protect the criminals. That's what's happened. You know, and they're tolerant of us. And
well, here's the hoping that's going to change.
Yeah.
That's all we can do is hope.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for coming back on, Mark.
And
thanks for making the efforts and having the courage that you do and the intelligence. And
yeah, we'll be out every month until justice is served. That's what we're hoping.
So. Yeah.
Okay, you have a good night.
Okay.
Bye.
Goodbye, Mark.
Bye-bye.
Jim, if you could manage your line for a minute, Jim, I'll be back in a moment.
Okay. Well, you're listening to Zero Point with Dr. Christopher Holmes. My name's Jim Moffitt, and as Chris mentioned at the outset of the program, the first half was the review of the 9/11 truth events in Ottawa. Christopher lives out just outside of Ottawa, and I live in Toronto. And in the second half of the program, we're going to discuss an article which appeared in the September 25th issue of the New York Review of Books, written by Dr. Steven Weinberg, who's a prominent American physicist and science writer who's written some best-selling science books, including, I think, the first 3 minutes was Steven Weinberg's best-known work, which is about the first 3 minutes after the Big Bang and talks about the physics of creation. And in his this article, it is entitled "Without God," and it appears, as I said, in a recent. I think this is the most recent issue, September 25th issue of the New York Review of Books, and it's about the confrontation between science and religion. And we're going to review this material and discuss it. This is. When I read this article, I emailed it to Chris immediately as I started to read it, because it was, as Yogi Berra once said, deja vu all over again, because it's essentially a restatement of a piece that Carl Sagan wrote many years ago in a book, Broke His Brain, which was published, I believe, in 1979 or 1978. And in that book, he had a piece called A Sunday Sermon, in which he considered the question of where religion fits today in terms of the progress of natural science. And in that piece, Sagan argued that as we come to have more and more scientific answers to scientific answers which provide scientific naturalistic explanations of phenomena in nature, there seems to be less and less, this is his words, there seems to be less and less for God to do. Sagan gave a few examples of natural phenomena. For instance, he talked about the opening of the morning glory. And he said it used to be believed that in ancient times that in order for the morning glory to open, there had to be some sort of supernatural intervention by God or some spiritual deity.
Yeah, he actually said, Jim, he actually said that God had to come down and say, "Hey, flower, open." He actually said
open.
That.
Yeah, he actually said that. Okay.
Yeah.
But then Sagan said, but now, with modern scientific examination of the problem, why and how the flower opens, how the flower opens, we know that really it's just a matter of plant hormones and heliotropism, that the sun and plant hormones account for the opening of the morning glory flower. And Sagan then goes on to very boldly proclaim it's really, this is true of the entire scheme of causality right back to the beginning of time. And then he says, it seems that as science advances, there is less and less for God to do. And this is what Chris labeled some 30 years ago, the problem of God's contracting universe. Is it true, in fact, that as we learn more and more through the scientific study of nature, that there's less and less for God to do? And in terms of the debate between religion and science, this is generally described as the God of the gaps. Like, as science progresses, there are fewer and fewer gaps in our knowledge, and that's where God essentially resides, because we don't need God once we have an explanation of these phenomena in terms of scientific processes. And weren't you struck, Chris, by Weinberg's article? How it's, when you were away from the phone, I said it's.
I was listening for much of it.
It's the old Yogi Berra thing. It's deja vu all over again. I couldn't believe this article. It's like, I mean, talk about cribbing from somebody. I mean, it's essentially a restatement of what, very much of, I think, of what Sagan says. I mean, maybe because I'm so familiar with the material, maybe he thinks that, you know, 30 years have elapsed, so it's kind of time to revisit and get his 2 cents worth in. But I was, I read this article, and I was, as I read it, my reaction was, well, I mean, I've read this before. This is essentially religious. This is essentially scientific fundamentalism, and it's the propagation of this creation myth that scientists put forth about the nature of the relationship between science and religion. It's complete hokum. It's complete bunkum. It's based on ignorance and a real selective examination of evidence. But I found it almost sickening at times. I had to sort of put it down. I thought, this is just so ridiculous and so disgusting that this guy publishes this article, and this guy's supposed to be a learned scientist, and certainly not, humility is not one of his long suits, I can certainly say that, but I just found it quite revolting, the whole thing. But in a way, I'm glad that he did publish it, because it gives me more ammunition in my own writing it updates that Carl Sagan is alive and well in the guise of Steven Weinberg.
Well, as you say, it certainly, to me, also brought back the deja vu experience and how obviously, like, essentially the same arguments as Sagan had back 30 years ago. And when we kind of both formulated the problem of God's contracting universe in looking at that attitude. And I was very pleased with it, because it made me realize everything, like in my writing, in the Heart Doctrine, where I introduced the problem of God's contracting universe and how I spell that out. And he verifies, like word for word, exactly what I was saying. It made me realize, even what I was writing 30 years ago is exactly contemporary as an issue still.
It's like I regard these people as being essentially scientific fundamentalists, and I think it's ironic that I think that they're very selective, and they tend to focus on a very select reading of religious scripture and dogma, and dismiss all of religion and all of spirituality on the basis that these very selective, usually fundamentalist or you know, discredited religious views, and show how science has triumphed over religion. But really, they're guilty of the same thing, in the sense that they subscribe to a very, very, very narrow understanding of science, and tend to create these polar extremes, like this in Gurdjieff's terms. It's this dichotomy between it's a formatory representation of the debate between religion and science. Like, one of the things that when Weinberg talks about science and religion, he's wrong about science, he's wrong about religion. When he talks about science, what he really means is he's talking about natural science, providing explanatory and causal explanations of things, explanatory frameworks and causal explanations. And what he's talking about, when he says natural science, this is a problem that David Ray Griffin identifies. He really means, David Ray Griffin calls this scientific naturalism, and then subscript SAM, sensationalism, atheism, and materialism, which is linked with a reductionist approach to the study of knowledge. So when they call, what these people call that scientific, natural science, they mean very specifically, they have a very specific understanding of what natural science means. But as David Ray Griffin and other people like Ian Barber, who have studied these problems extensively from a much more informed perspective than Sagan and Weinberg and Dawkins and these people, as they point out, there's nothing inherent in scientific naturalism which precludes spirituality or alternative understandings which would allow, for instance, your model of human beings as being multidimensional beings that exist in a multidimensional universe. See, what Weinberg does is he dismisses all all perspectives outside of his sensationalist, atheistic, materialist, reductionist perspective as being supernatural. He uses that term throughout the article, you'll notice, scientific progress is doing away with supernaturalism, but he never defines what he means by supernaturalism. See, I mean, in a sense, I would say that what he calls the supernatural, I would call just part of nature. I mean, I would call it it's natural in terms of the model that you're putting forth. Like, I mean, I believe that the existence of the astral body, for example, is a natural phenomenon. I don't think there's anything supernatural about it at all. It's just it's supernatural because it's beyond. It's beyond the senses in terms of being able to perceive it or be able to detect it. But there's nothing unnatural or supernatural about it. It's one of those hidden variables in nature which inform the material plane. And I would say that applies to the entire kind of model that you put forth and that appears regularly in the esoteric teachings about the nature of consciousness and about the nature of the universe. So on that very basic level, like, I think he really misrepresents science in that way. And then the other side of it is in his representation of religion. As I say, this is the oldest trick in the book for guys like Sagan and for Dawkins and for Daniel Dennett and for all these naysayers, all these people who put forth these scientific refutations of religious teachings. They have this very, very limited understanding of religion, and they never really go into any kind of detailed examination of theology or of religious teachings, and they have absolutely no conception or give no indication that they're even aware of the esoteric tradition and how that relates to the exoteric tradition in religion. No. So their entire discussion is like so limited and so formatory, again, like in Gurdjieff terms, it's so mechanical, it's so superficial that it's essentially stupid. That's the word for it. It's stupid. It's a rigged game, you know. The deck is stacked, and there's no way and what is so interesting about it is that if you read it on a superficial level, like 35 years ago, I would have probably read this and thought, well, that's a very reasonable and intelligent article, because I didn't know anything about the esoteric tradition, and you know, I would have been sympathetic to the argument, because there's much that science has revealed about religion which pokes holes in religious teachings and which shows that they're superficial and shows that they're not credible. But it's the old case of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, you know, just because certain religious teachings or certain interpretations of religious teachings aren't true doesn't mean that all religious teachings or all religious interpretations aren't true. I mean, it's completely ludicrous.
Yeah, I found, like, there's so many fallacies in thinking through all his article.
Yeah.
And as you say, it struck me, like, Gurdjieff has this derogatory term, formatory thinking. And
yeah.
He says formatory thinking is always, like, the most simplistic way of approaching anything, and usually it's dualistic in nature, so you always kind of see things dualistically. And the whole Weinberg, every paragraph is kind of formatory, and he has his dualistic, like, science and religion and reason versus irrationality, like all this formatory thinking. And as you say, he's contrasting science and religion, but he misrepresents what real science is, and then he misrepresents what religion is, so he's wrong on both counts.
One thing that I was reading that I was struck by a little bit this time was in just this question of the God of the gaps, is, you know, that this point is that okay, we get more and more, as science progresses, we learn more and more about the natural world, and we have more detailed and more complicated explanations in terms of various sciences, which provide us with an understanding of what we observe in nature. And so Sagan's point, which is reiterated by Weinberg, is that it seems there's less and less for God to do. But two problems with that. So God ends up in the gaps in our knowledge. It's only where we don't understand, where mystery still abides, that's where God has room to continue to exist. But there's two problems with that. Number one is that just because you can explain that water is composed of two hydrogen molecules and one oxygen molecule, doesn't really mean that it's a molecule composed of these two elements, I should say, doesn't really mean that you've explained water in its entirety. We can provide incredibly detailed explanations of various processes in the brain, but that doesn't mean we understand consciousness. We can explain, provide sophisticated models of the human body and all its various subsystems and everything, but that doesn't mean that we understand human life. And so there are always sort of essential mysteries that even when we have these detailed explanations, which scientists always say are only approximations because we're always refining our knowledge and progressing, there still remains mystery within what we know. But also, in addition to that, in terms of the gaps, it's like, it's interesting because he assumes a priori that religion has nothing to teach us about the world. He says it has no application beyond human beings themselves. Nothing external to human beings is explained by religion. But again, this is a very, overly simplistic understanding of religion, and also just completely ignores the wealth of ideas that are contained in the esoteric spiritual traditions about the nature of human beings and the nature of the world and the nature of the relationship between human beings and the universe. And so he says that when he's talking about God in the gaps, he's basically assuming that there's nothing there, that God is just a name that people invoke to comfort themselves, that there's some sort of meaning to their lives. But God and religion and spirituality encompass this entire wealth of knowledge about who we are and what we're doing here, and that's completely ignored in these discussions. Like, it's like God is this big zero that sits in the gaps, you know? Like, it's nonsensical.
Yeah, maybe I marked my copy up as I went through.
Yeah.
Maybe I could pull out a few quotes.
Yeah.
He starts out talking about how as science advances, there's kind of less belief. It undermines belief in religions. And one point here, because science deals only with facts and religion only with values. That's an example of what I would call formatory thinking.
Yeah.
That science deals only with facts.
Yeah.
Well, it's not so simple like that. What facts are facts are subjects to interpretation, and there are scientific assumptions. Science doesn't only deal with facts. It's based on a whole network of assumptions and beliefs about acquiring knowledge and methods and things like that. Science also has values intrinsic to science. And then he says science deals with facts, religion only with values. Well, religion does deal with values, but he doesn't think that religion has any facts.
Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't think there could be anything factual to religion, but he never examines any religious idea to look at, could it have a factual basis? Like,
yeah.
He has no idea that religion is supposed to be a science of the soul, and
yeah.
That religions articulate ideas about the nature of the soul and how to awaken to within your soul life, how to acquire your soul. So religion is a kind of a science of consciousness, but he doesn't deal with that at all.
Yeah.
He doesn't think religion could have any facts. So that's kind of dualistic.
Yeah, Along that line, that's what I was sort of getting at too. Is like, I mean, okay, as I say, he has this formatory appreciation and superficial appreciation of religion, and like, take for example the Christian Trinity of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. Okay, that's an idea that, you know, all Christians are familiar with and have various levels of understanding of, but if you go beyond the teaching that you know that God is the Trinity and start to think of this in terms of how it relates to the ideas of other religious teachings about the threefoldness of things and begin to examine it from like a Gurdjieffian perspective as a fundamental cosmic law of the law of three, then it goes beyond. It's not simply a dogmatic assertion about the nature of God, but the idea of the Trinity. But it's part of this of this fundamental cosmic law, and you start to see applications of this on all levels of existence, both in terms of the human psyche, but also in terms of the existence of the physical universe. And I mean, it becomes a very profound idea. And like, you know, you and I, when we started studying the Law of Three 30 years ago, had a certain understanding of it. Now we have a much more profound understanding of it, and it continues to evolve. So in a sense, it's a scientific, I would say the Law of Three is an esoteric scientific teaching, because you continue to gather evidence and observations and weigh it in terms of this theoretical position, and you get a more complex, comprehensive explanation of things. Seems to me a perfectly, you know.
Yeah, that's such a good example. Yeah, the idea, and we see this principle of the Law of Three. We find it in Kabbalistic teaching, where you have the Tree of Life, which sits on three pillars, and it's composed of three triangles and the tenth point. And we see it in the Vedic teachings of India, where they say there are three modes of nature, each ruled by a demigod, and these are related to matter, energy, and intelligence. So we see the idea of the Law of Three can be applied within science. It's a principle, a way of understanding things, and how, compared with mystical teachings, modern scientists always think in twos. They always think there's matter and energy, observer, observed, the mind and the body, the material body and the immaterial soul. Like, they're always thinking dualistically, whereas mystical teachings, we always look to understand the triune nature of any phenomena. So it's a way of thinking about the triune nature of things, which is beyond the scientist's dualistic way of approaching subjects.
Yeah, it's interesting too, and that's a further example of the Law of Three, is that it's interesting how these scientists are always trying to suggest trying to identify the psychological functions through like wish fulfillment and satisfaction and self-aggrandizement and comfort in the face of the unknown that religious teachings supply religious believers. Yet, in terms of the Law of Three, one of the things that from the Gurdjieff perspective is so interesting is he said this is an inherent property of the waking consciousness, that our normal waking consciousness is that we tend to see things in twos, that we don't recognize the third element of things, which completes things and which provides a more comprehensive perspective. So like it's a fundamental feature of our normal waking state of consciousness that we see things in twos, and yet this is the teaching of the Law of Three suggests that we have to go beyond the superficial, beyond the obvious, beyond the manifest, to understand the hidden the third element in things, and it's like the hidden variable which informs things, or it's the medium in which things occur often, which forms the third element. And when you apply that perspective, you know, it's a tool that you apply things. You begin to see its application, and I would say in terms of understanding modern psychology and modern thought, like to me that's where the Law of Three really began to take on incredible significance and meaning, because I saw that modern thought is riddled with these formatory, like mechanical formulations of everything in terms of this and that, you know, one or the other. Everything's in twos, whereas when you start to see things in terms of the threes, it provides, it's not just simply a matter of, well, why not fours, why not fives, why not sixes, why not sevens. It's not just simply a matter of adding another number, but it's such a valuable heuristic for organizing information and for seeing the inherent assumptive framework which people aren't aware of, which limits their understanding of things, you know, which I would say, in the grander scheme of things, I would say, yeah, one of the reasons why he doesn't want to recognize the supernatural is because he can't recognize the supernatural, because he's caught up in the natural, which is an expression of the limits of his consciousness, you know, like it sort of stands things on its head. Like he's seeing how religion comforts people and gives them this this what he feels is a false sense of meaning and relationship. But I would say the same thing about most of modern science and most of modern thought, that it's based on an equally illusory quality which misleads people and which satisfies them with superficial explanations. And that's what I would say is part of the false consciousness system that you mentioned earlier from Gurdjieff. I think that's a big part of it, is that people want to see things in the limited materialistic perspective of the normal waking consciousness and psyche.
Yeah, it's as Gurdjieff says at one point, he says, if we could see the real world, the world as it is, we would recognize third, fourth.
Yeah.
But in our normal state, we only see that we see things dualistically. But if we could, I think the most important example of this in science has been the fact that science traditionally has distinguished between matter and energy. And this has been the main dual principles in science for the last 50-100 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the newest science, they now regard information as third force. And this is very important in holographic models, that information is immaterial, but it's latent within the medium of space itself. So in Talbot's book called The Holographic Universe, he says the new science is recognizing third force, which is intelligence.
Right.
So a lot of people now, you know, they think Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, kind of showed the equivalence of matter and energy. And so everybody, all the New Age people were saying, so everything is energy, and energy can't be created or destroyed. And they think that's advanced. But really, the new science suggests everything has a material, energetic, and intelligence or information aspect to it. So this idea of the threefold nature of the universe, and that there is intelligence latent within the medium. So the transformations of matter and energy that occur are guided by the intelligence which is latent within the medium. So this has kind of profound significance in terms of the new quantum physics and quantum theory and information theory that's arisen in science. But
yeah, and again, it's consistent with an idea that's about 5,000 years old of the tradition of the three gunas
in yogic teachings, the three gunas.
Matter, energy, and intelligence, you know. It's like,
That goes, and the human being, you see in modern psychology, for the last 100 years, it's been defined as the science of behavior and the mind. So you got behavior, which is like the material body, and the mind in the head. So you have a brain and the body. It's dualistic. Okay, whereas from a mystical perspective, a human being has, first you might say he functions mentally, emotionally, and physically, head, heart, and hands. Okay, so it's not just the mind and the head and the body. There's also the emotional side. There's head, heart, and hands. So we have a threefold nature. And then we have a body, a soul, and a spirit. So we have a threefold nature of body, soul, and spirit. Whereas the scientists, when they think about the paranormal, they just think that, they raise the question, is there an immaterial soul to connect to the material body? Whereas from a mystical perspective, that's nonsense. The soul is material, but it's just material of a different density of vibration and a different energetic level. And intelligence level. So the whole duality of a material body and an immaterial soul is a completely false dichotomy.
Yeah,
because the body isn't simply so material.
Yeah.
It's not simply material. Physics shows us that. And the immaterial soul isn't simply immaterial. It is material also. It's just material of a different substance. But they cast all their issues in simple dualistic way.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that too, because this sort of jumped off the page to me on page 74. He's talking about how disturbed religious conservatives will be when, quote, when at last scientists learn how to understand human behavior in terms of the chemistry and physics of the brain, and nothing is left that needs to be explained by or having an immaterial soul. Like, that sentence is so full of wrong ideas. It's like, it's, you know, like, I mean, all wrong, you know, I mean, from beginning to end. I mean, first, scientists are going to understand human behavior, and they're going to understand it in terms of the chemistry and physics of the brain, and therefore, nothing's going to be left that needs to be explained by our having an immaterial soul. Well, you know, who says the soul is immaterial?
Yeah.
You know, who says it's the physics and chemistry of the brain that's going to explain human behavior? You know, I mean, it's
wrong.
You know, like, I mean, wrong on all levels. I mean,
yeah.
Like,
and the beginning of that paragraph, he has another point I really objected to. He said, most important so far has been the discovery by Charles Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace that humans arose from earlier animals through natural selection acting on random hereditary variations with no need for a divine plan to explain the advent of humanity.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, like, firstly, he makes it sound as though, oh, Charles Darwin discovered that we're only animals that arose through random genetic changes. Well, that's a high, that, is not a discovery. Like, Darwin postulated that. He didn't discover it, and there's still so many enigmas within biology and science that it's not proven that human beings arose through random genetic changes. There's no proof of this. In fact, it's almost a non-scientific postulate to say that evolution is guided by random happenings, random mutations. What is the evidence that it's random?
And this is part of this whole fundamentalist scientific camp where they keep trying to suggest that somehow that the existence... See, like, I believe in the theory of evolution, many aspects of it, that it happened, and I believe there are all sorts of random processes. But to believe in that as one level of explanatory framework doesn't mean that that's a comprehensive explanation for the advent of humanity. Doesn't even mean it's a comprehensive explanation of the arising of one living, breathing organism possessing consciousness. I mean, it's completely ridiculous to think that somehow exhausts the question. And that's
That's how it's presented.
Yeah.
Oh, Darwin discovered this. You know. Okay. Nice. Now we should just accept it.
That's a very important point you're making. He didn't discover this. He postulated that.
Yeah.
Like, that's a huge distinction. I mean, we're not just quibbling over words. He was trying to provide an explanation of what he observed, and he postulated this. He didn't discover this. It's like Bacon in one of his books says that evolution is a fact. And one of the critiques I read of it by a religious scholar is, well, wait a minute, evolution isn't a fact. Nobody was there to sort of observe it. It's a theory put forth to try to account for observable evidence and facts, you know, no more, no less, you know. And I mean, as I say, broad strokes, I believed in the theory of evolution, but I don't think that it exhausts the explanation of the arising of humankind. And it's the same, like, you know, I believe in many of the tenets of modern biology, but I don't think that provides an exhaustive explanation of what a human being is, even on the physical level, because I believe in the higher dimensional and subtle anatomy as higher dimensional nature of human beings and the subtle anatomy and the fact that we have to go beyond the material and the plane to account for the consistency of the human body and of the human form, you know. Like, it's the same with consciousness. Like, you know, I believe that, yes, it's important to study the brain and its processes in accounting for a human consciousness, but I don't think that provides an exhaustive explanation of consciousness. It's ridiculous.
Okay, well, I'm trying to pick up on.
Oh yeah. Well, there's so many things to object to.
Yeah, there's so many things to object to. Yeah, there is.
This is one other thing too. I just again, this is to me like this occurs in the writings of Sagan, Daniel Dennett, Richard Fenneman, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins. All of these people keep talking about how religion portrays, like, it's Fenneman's thing is that the religious explanation is too provincial. Sagan almost repeats that, recapitulates that word for word. He's talking about the second source of tension between science and religion. He says, the special place of man as an actor created by God to play a standing part in a great cosmic drama of sin and salvation. And he says that science has done away with the special place of humankind portrayed by religion. But I mean,
that's so funny because
it's such a
when you think of though what he's saying. To quote it again, as Richard Feynman has said, okay, he's quoting Feynman, he says, the theory that it's all arranged as a stage for God to watch man's struggle for good and evil seems inadequate. And what struck me is, wow, how can you say, look at the world around you at the moment, and you have a stage for God to watch man struggle between good and evil. It's happening now.
It is happening in the world.
There is this huge struggle going on.
Well, it's what Milton wrote about, is this huge struggle, too. Like, I mean, Paradise Lost and Paradise Regained. And I mean, it's been an ongoing theme. But, I'll take that. I mean, on some level, that's exactly right. But on another level, too, it's like this idea that somehow religions teach exaggerate the importance of human beings in relation to the universe, to the size of the universe, and that somehow by scientific knowledge we've realized that how vast the universe is and how puny we really are. Like, you know, we're just this little speck in it. Well, that's all based on an understanding. First of all, religions don't teach that exclusively. Some religions may overemphasize some interpretations of religious teachings may overemphasize the importance of human beings. But then, let's take an example like Yogananda. What does Yogananda's experience of cosmic consciousness teach us about the place of human beings in the cosmos? I mean,
his experience suggests that we are somehow interconnected to the whole of the cosmos. So each
exactly.
of us, in a way, has this profound depth,
and that
each of us, in a way, is an expression of the universe. So we're not simply an isolated person in a huge universe, but that we have this deep interconnectedness to the universe.
Yeah, and I mean, you can interpret that on a whole variety of levels. On one level, what you have to do is you have to get over yourself to know and understand this, in the sense that you have to do away with the illusory aspects of your normal waking consciousness to acquire consciousness to experience this. But also in another sense, it's like what it kind of shows is that there is no, his experience is that there is no here or there. Like, I mean, the cosmos is on one level can be understood as this unfathomably huge array of space and time, but on another level it can all be collapsed if we really know ourselves, and so, you know, there is no space and time on some level if we really knew ourselves. And then the other side of it is, of course, is that that in essence we are all special in a sense. We all are God's children. We all are related to God. We can all know God, but most of us don't because of the limits of our consciousness. I mean, there's a variety of ways you can interpret that, but to simplistically say that, well, religion is, you know, overemphasizes and gives man this special sense of his place in the cosmos, I don't know where people get that, you know, like maybe from some fundamentalist Christian teachings, but, and that's another thing too, is that when they say this, it's like, they're talking very specifically about the Christian Bible, I think, you know, and a very specific interpretation of the Christian Bible. I mean, how in the world you would ever get that kind of understanding of what religion teaches from, like, Buddhist scriptures or from Hindu scriptures is beyond me, or from Kabbalistic scriptures. I mean, it just, you know, it's just...
No, he only deals with a caricature of what religion is.
Exactly. It's this straw man, this pony straw man that these guys erect so that they can rationally, you know, skewer and shred this thing. But I mean, it's completely an unrealistic portrait. I mean, as I say, it's trying to reduce, you know, an incredibly complex and multi-leveled, multi-dimensional phenomena into this very superficial, very circumscribed entity which you can attack, you know. I mean, it's,
yeah.
Which is religion. And on the other hand, science, you know, because science is equally much more complex than Weinberg and Sagan and their confreres let on.
Yeah, listen to some of this. He's saying the worldview of science is rather chilling. Not only do we not find any point to life laid out for us in nature, which I completely disagree with, that I say there is a point in life from a religious, mystical perspective, which is to know ourselves and to awaken and to attain our souls.
Yeah.
But he has none of that. But he says in science, there's no point to life laid out for us in nature. Then he says there's no objective basis for our moral principles. And I disagree completely with that because I believe inherent to the nature of the human heart, people have conscience, and there that you know intuitively, there's an intuitive knowing of what is good and evil. There can be in human beings. They can lose that, but there is an objective basis for moral principles. Then he says there's no correspondence between what we think is the moral law and the laws of nature.
Yeah.
And then he goes on, he says, we even learn that the emotions that we most treasure, our love for our wives and husbands and children, are made possible by chemical processes in our brain. Okay? In our brains.
Yeah.
Okay, so which
love
is
you with all my limbic system.
Sorry, Jim?
I love you with all my limbic system.
Yeah, I love you. Yeah, everybody, don't send your sweetheart or your sweet brain Valentine with a head on it, okay, showing your limbic system. I love you with all my head, he must say to his wife. So he has no idea that emotions maybe aren't just up in the brain.
Yeah.
And then he says, and these are made possible by chemical processes in our brain that are what they are as a result of natural selection acting on chance mutation over millions of years.
Yeah.
Okay, like, where's the evidence for this? Like, this is complete confabulation.
Completely ludicrous. And as you say, you know, if you read something like something really profound, like Gurdjieff's explanation and Beelzebub's tales to his grandson about the objective nature of conscience, that is such a profound teaching about. The difference between what Gurdjieff would say, conscience and morality. Like he says, you know, morality is different depending on, you know, different countries, different religions, different times, different peoples, different ethnic groups.
External influences.
External influences. Morality is different. It's everywhere different. What's moral in one country is immoral in another country. What's moral in one group is immoral in another group. But he said conscience is objective and is the same everywhere. Now that's a very profound idea, and something clearly that Weinberg doesn't recognize or doesn't have any clue about. I mean, we could talk about that for 2 hours on this program and not even begin to scratch the surface of the possible meaning of that. I there was something earlier when he was talking about behavior and consciousness that I just wanted to raise. He said, note that I refer here to behavior, not consciousness. And then he goes on, he says, consciousness refers to the subjective, where behavior is externally objective. And he says, as Colin McGinn has said in these pages, the problem is how to integrate the meaning of the New York Review of Books. The problem is how to integrate the conscious mind with the physical brain, how to reveal a unity beneath this apparent diversity. That problem is very hard, and I do not believe anyone has any good ideas about how to solve it.
But now, it shows how he has no idea how to solve it, but he assumes that the conscious mind is only connected to the material brain.
Yeah.
He makes that assumption.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he says, we don't have any idea how it works, but somehow the conscious mind is produced by the material brain. He makes that assumption.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, That's the assumption, and yet the other side of it too is he says, I don't think anybody has any good ideas. Well, what about the whole esoteric tradition of the study of consciousness? And this really goes to the heart of what's wrong with this consideration of science versus religion, is that these guys don't, none of these people recognize the idea that the esoteric schools, which are responsible for all religions, deal with the concept of developing consciousness and transforming consciousness. And all of these religious teachings originally had an instrumental aspect which taught you how to be and taught you how to know God. And it's not just a matter of faith, and it's not just a matter of adhering to dogma or subscribing to irrational beliefs or superstitions or having faith in the sense that they mean it. I mean, these religious teachings had this instrumental aspect, and as they entered the external world and became more and more deviated and distorted, the religious teachings lost their instrumental aspect. That's been a huge problem with the religious teachings in the West, and why, like Jacob Needleman said in the 60s, why young people turned to Buddhism and various Eastern teachings, to Zen, to various Eastern teachings, is because the instrumental aspect is more preserved in those teachings and is much more readily apparent, and gives people like practices like yoga and meditation, which are vital to developing consciousness and to transforming consciousness. So, like, there's this whole super sophisticated science of the psyche and the soul, which is inherent in all religious teachings, but which is, you know, which is dormant in many interpretations of religious teachings. And that's what these guys don't recognize. And it deals directly with the issue of consciousness, which is central to all understanding and all human knowledge. We have to deal with the issue of consciousness. Go back to what you said at the beginning of the program. As Gurdjieff said, we don't know what consciousness is because we don't have it.
Yeah, we're not properly conscious.
We're not properly conscious, yeah.
I like this quote from Weinberg, too. It shows his attitude. He says, for some, there is also a sort of spirituality that Emerson wrote about, and which I don't understand, often described as a sense of union with nature or with all humanity that doesn't involve any special beliefs about the supernatural. And that's so interesting, because this is what mystics say, that through the opening of the heart, one can experience a sense of union with nature or with all humanity. That people have those experiences. Different types of states of union are described throughout the mystical literature. So that's what happens to people directly once you begin these practices. You can attain experiences of unity with different. Sometimes it's just being able to be aware of everything around you. Other times it's experiencing a feeling of love or compassion for all people, or feeling all human beings are part of one living soul. Like, we can have these experiences of union at different levels. In fact, levels of samadhi are different states of union that can be achieved through yogic practices. So here in his article, Weinberg kind of says, well, he has that idea, this idea of union with nature and all humanity, but he says, and which I don't understand. And he doesn't understand that. That is the problem. You know, he doesn't experience that. He experiences himself more as an isolated ego existing within an external space. He doesn't experience those states of union. And again, it comes back to his kind of mental focus, because the mind in the head always discriminates between things and sees things as opposing, whereas within the heart is where things are unified. The experiences of unity are dependent upon the awakening of the heart.
Yeah, precisely. I wanted to just mention too, like, what the fourth source of tension he talks about, how religion relies on authority, whereas science is self-correcting and doesn't subscribe to dogma. It's always challenging its beliefs and everything. It's very interesting, because when Carl Sagan's book, The Demon-Haunted World, came out in, I don't know when that was, about 1990, no, actually it had to be earlier, maybe 92, 93, something like that. Anyway, it was reviewed by Richard Lawton, American biologist, in the New York Review of Books. And in that book, Sagan had raised the same question, had raised the same issue, that he said that, you know, that science doesn't rely on authority as religion does. And Lawton said this. He said, "It is said that there is no place for an argument from authority in science. The community of science is constantly self-critical. But when scientists transgress the boundaries of their own specialty, they have no choice but to accept the claims of authority, even though they do not know how solid the claims may be." Now, earlier on, he's criticized Richard Dawkins and E.O. Wilson, the sociobiologist who Sagan upholds as being outstanding exemplars of scientific writing. And he says, "Who am I to believe about quantum physics if not Steven Weinberg, or about the solar system if not Carl Sagan? What worries me is that they may believe what Dawkins and Wilson tell them about evolution."
Yeah.
He has this great put down of Dawkins and Wilson, which goes on quite lengthy, which is hilarious, because he says, you know, like, I'll just tell you very quickly, Dawkins' vulgarization of Darwinism speaks of nothing but in evolution but an inexorable ascendancy of genes that are selectively superior, while the entire body of technical advance in experimental and theoretical evolutionary genetics of the last 50 years has moved in the direction of emphasizing non-selective forces in evolution. So, like, even when these guys are popping off about religion and, you know, explaining to us that it's all just wish fulfillment and some sort of illusion or delusion, I mean, even within their own areas, you know, Dawkins is supposed to be this authority on genetics, but Lawton says he's a clown, you know, that he's completely misrepresents his own field, that, you know, the whole thrust of evolutionary genetic biology in the last 50 years is towards non-selective, you know, processes, and it's selective processes, which Dawkins says, you know, gives us the selfish gene, and which leads him to entitle a chapter in his book, Why There Almost Certainly Is No God. So, you know, like, I mean, again, it's this, but I thought it was so interesting that Weinberg brings up exactly the same thing, you know, about, oh, religion relies on authority and blindly believing people. Well, you know, what if not is modern science? But, you know, who are we supposed to believe about the solar system or about nuclear physics if we don't, you know, believe authorities? We can, you know, it's just too specialized. We don't know these things, you know.
Yeah, through our first-hand experience, we do rely on authority. And
yeah, I mean, science is built on authority. I mean, of course, it's open to challenges on evidentiary basis, and that's one way that science in general is superior to, I would say, traditional religions, because there is a dogmatic aspect to so much of traditional religion, you know, that people become fixed in their beliefs about things and don't really open them up for examination. But that hardly describes all of religious or spiritual teachings, and I think that's what's so interesting about your work and the work that we've been doing for the last 30 years, is that you can see there's a real possibility of integrating and reinforcing the progress of both science and religion by trying to understand how each informs the other, because I really believe that that's, you know, essential to progress in science and religion, is that we have to take elements from both and understand how it provides a radically, you know, different understanding of who we are and what the nature of the universe is.
Yeah, and that understanding, it's not inconsistent with the facts of science. In fact, the facts of science can be reinterpreted in alternative ways which support this alternate model.
Yeah.
Of existence, that you can actually interpret the facts of science in an alternate way. Like, Weinberg makes it sound as though the facts of science are so firmly established, kind of.
Yeah.
But in a way, it's the interpretation of those facts and the meaning of the context of how they're interpreted. Like, Weinberg might say, okay, scientists can trace the universe back to an original singularity point, and then it popped before that, it popped out of the quantum vacuum. Okay. Well,
in the book of Genesis, it says, in the beginning, the earth was empty and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. Now, that idea essentially says that in the beginning, like, everything was absorbed in nothingness, like nothing was manifested. So in the book of Genesis actually suggests this idea of vacuum Genesis.
Yeah.
In the Christian tradition, it was called creation ex nihilo,
yeah,
creation out of nothingness. And you also find the same idea of creation out of nothingness is basic to Kabbalistic teachings, where they have Ein Sof Hour, three realms of negative existence, all part of the nothingness that gives birth to the universe. And it's in the Vedic teachings, when the three gunas are perfectly symmetrical and then hence signless, unmanifested. So this idea of creation out of nothingness is in the different religious teachings.
Yeah.
So, but Weinberg would say, oh yeah, I believe in vacuum Genesis, now we don't need religion. But kind of religion was saying, arguing like vacuum Genesis several thousand years prior to you, Mr. Weinberg.
The Kabbalistic teachings in the 14th century were talking about creation involving the emergence out of a singularity, a single point of light, you know, that quote, that the Jonathan Cott quote that you have on the site, you know. And I mean, you know, there are numerous examples of this across all sorts of different religious traditions and esoteric traditions, that, you know, ideas being expressed about the nature of creation which are entirely consistent with our modern scientific understanding, and in some ways, I think, go beyond, because I think they explore principles that aren't understood by science. And that's why I say that, you know, the integration of science and religion is, I think, the really important step in furthering human knowledge on a variety of levels, both on the psychological and the cosmological level.
Yeah, that's why I work under Zero Point Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science, because we're arguing that there is a science to religion and mysticism, and we're also saying we need a science that has values in it and that's consistent with spiritual science.
Yeah, we have to go.
So we have to go. Thanks very much, James Moffat from Toronto, Ontario, Christopher Holmes from Ottawa. Thank you all of BBS Radio. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Thanks,
keep the
guys.
Faith.